Welcome to Temporality, a podcast about art and the human experience. The general theme of this show is to be a kind of stockpile of thoughts on art, music, film, literature, life, connection, disconnection, and whatever may fall in between and around. It seemed like a fitting theme for the introductory episode to revolve around the topics of innovation and time. It's been said that we live in a cultural climate which is post-everything. Very little feels new. So what does it mean to be original in a world where it's all been done before? Is there any story that hasn't been told? There are two interlocking truths to this. The first is that there is no event horizon at which the human intellect will irreparably hit the wall and all innovation or originality will be rendered obsolete. The second is that, yes, on some level it is true, that it's all been done before, when you break art down to its bare components. How many biblical retellings over the last 2,000 years? How many heroes' journeys? How many of the same oral myths and legends? In the preface of Grief Lessons, Anne Carson's 2006 translation of four plays by Euripides, she writes, "One of the functions of the tragic chorus is to reflect on the action of the play and try to assign it some meaning. They typically turn to the past in their search for the meaning of the present, scanning history and myth for precedent. It was Homer who suggested we stand in time with our backs to the future, face to the past. What happens if a man turns around? Then the chorus will necessarily fall silent. This story has not happened before. Notice they do not dance again. Let the future begin." This concept of walking backwards through time, facing the past with our backs to the future, also exists as a Maori proverb, explored in contemporary artist Shannon Te Ao's 2020 multimedia piece, Kamua Kamuri. A description of the piece from Art Now New Zealand writes that Kamua Kamuri suggests that time exists on a continuum where past, present, and future coexist and are inherently tethered through ancestry and action. Te Ao describes this piece as a time travel film, its subjects featured in cars, in transit, layered with Maori lyrical traditions such as proverbs and songs. The past and present are interwoven, not so much an arrow shot through time on a terminal velocity into the future, but a reflecting pole which ripples as we pass through. Euripides' Heracles wrestles with this concept of the terminal velocity of time. Heracles has lost a swath of his life from his time away completing his labors. When he returns, he's struck with madness and driven into a frenzy that leads him to slaughter his wife and children. There is no going back from this moment. The chasm of time between the person he was when he left and the moment he stands at the precipice of now cannot be crossed. His past is a horror to him. He has outlived his myth. His future, should it exist, is entirely opaque. While yes, at the time of its creation, this type of story is one that very well may not have been told before, at least not in this context and not in this specific medium, maybe not even in fiction, but its subject matter, its themes, and the emotions conjured by it remain relevant, as we say, timeless because of their relatability. Grieving taught me to see time differently. There was before and after. A chasm opened between the person I had been when I heard the news and what felt like the disintegrating cliff I stood on after finding out, an avalanche waiting to happen. One wrong move, and it felt as if this gaping timelessness itself would swallow me. Timelessness in the sense of transcending time. Timelessness in the sense of being apart from time. Neither here nor there, but simultaneously everywhere. What we call non-duality, or singularity. I am not the first to grieve. Heracles was not the first to consider the void between what was and what, for better or worse, must be. In reality, past and present are more connected than they are separate, a temporal non-duality. We are always looking at the past through the concave lens of the future. There are, of course, those who believe that art, music, film, and literature have no obligation to remember or to recognize the past, that old traditions should be paved over to make way for the innovations and new technology of the future, and that any regard for the past is a caustic nostalgia which holds us back from our most noble pursuit, moving forward. I consider this mindset hubristic and frankly white supremacist in nature. The primary aim of colonial settlement is to dismantle indigenous tradition, erase history, and rebuild in the modern image of the colonizer. White supremacist notions of history are generally simulacra, heavily revised and fictionalized in order to produce an image of greatness. Nostalgia in the eye of the white supremacist is reserved not for a lifestyle within a period of time which actually existed, but for a sort of commercial retelling of the past in which everything was beautiful for the white upstanding citizen and nothing hurt. A perfectly staged film set against which the real world can never measure up. To take this away is an unbearable indignity. It shatters the illusion the white supremacist has created for themselves, that this way of living really did exist, and it really is their fault that it no longer does. In order to maintain this illusion, the actuality of the past, with its foibles and unflattering angles, the presence of cultures and traditions and ways of life which the white supremacist wishes to erase, must be bulldozed. The land must be razed, its people re-educated, often forcibly, propagandized, traditions outlawed, art and cultural products destroyed outright or seized and held behind glass by those who profitize the destruction of their homeland. More graciously, the belief in progress and newness as the most important pursuit of art is simply reactionary. It comes from the same kind of hand-wringing despair as the idea that we're running out of ideas and that only what has never been done before is worthwhile. The belief that our perception of time is a straight line with one clear trajectory, that we face forward with our backs to the past. The father of futurism, poet Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, delivered in his Futurist Manifesto a rallying cry to destroy the institutions and traditions of the past to make way for the ideals of the modern futurist movement. The manifesto utilizes fascist values and violent imagery of battle and conquest, a visceral fight to set fire to the past in order to clear the way for single-minded focus on progress and innovation. Technological advancement to reign supreme, and would go on to be an influential text in shaping the political ideologies of Benito Mussolini. Marinetti's Futurist political party, which heralded the ideals present in his manifesto, including racism, the glorification of war, and the abhorrence of feminism, later merged with Mussolini's Fascist Party, for which Marinetti co-wrote yet another reactionary manifesto. In spite of its decidedly fascist origins in politics, the Futurist movement also promoted otherwise progressive ideas aimed to democratize the creation of art and music. Composer Francesco Bellilipretella's Manifesto of Futurist Musicians encouraged young musicians to abandon the model of academic and conservatory study, to take their musical education into their own hands and experiment freely with sound. Composer John Cage, himself inspired by the Futurist movement, writes in Future of Music, "If this word music is sacred and reserved for 18th and 19th century instruments, we can substitute a more meaningful term, organization of sound." Cage correctly predicted that technological and social advancements would lead to a movement of music made not with instruments, but with machines. Later, he writes, "The composer, organizer of sound, will be faced with not only the entire field of sound, but also with the entire field of time." At the time of its 1913 premiere, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was widely regarded to be an abject failure. Disparaged by factitious newspaper reports alleging riots and arrest over outrage towards the piece, it's no stretch to say that the Rite of Spring was a particularly contentious and polarizing work, something which has contributed to its timelessness. In the canon of classical music, the Rite of Spring falls under the modernist movement. Far from the twinkly Regency Baroque and bombastic symphonies of composers such as Bach and Beethoven that we normally laud as representational of the umbrella term that is classical, the Rite of Spring came about at the cusp of rapid industrialization and radically changing social attitudes. Although contemporary belief is that the Rite of Spring was panned for being too ahead of its time, anachronistic in its own era, the piece is a work of primitivism, a 20th century movement incorporating rhythms, traditions, and themes from indigenous music of Africa, Eastern Europe, as well as East and West Asia. The subjects of the Rite of Spring and its accompanying ballet are a society of Russian pagans, implicitly from a time before Christianity reached Russia in the 10th century. For this, one review in The Guardian referred to the piece as unnecessarily ugly and willfully extravagant. Its choreography was seen as an insult to the art form of ballet. Its movements are frenetic, not the tightly controlled fluidity of works in the canon of classical ballet, but expressive, at times explosive. Its protagonist, the Chosen One, standing immobile for the entirety of the 11th movement. In Tamara Levitt's Racism at the Right, featured in The Rite of Spring at 100, she writes, "The spectators in the balcony experience Nijinsky's choreography orally as an aggressive assault of endless stamping and visually as a distasteful display of denatured, incomprehensible movement." In A Century of Rites, The Making of an Avant-Garde Tradition, featured in the same compilation, Lynn Garofola writes, "The Rite continues to be a work that insists upon its modernity, its engagement with the contemporary world." The Rite of Spring's precarious balance between past and present, the primitive and modern, the traditional and the avant-garde, is what has cemented its status as one of the most influential works of the 20th century. Its reverberations can be felt throughout the works of Stravinsky's contemporaries of the early 20th century, to Disney's Fantasia, to The Smiths, to avant-garde saxophonist Ornette Coleman's piece Sleep Talking, and many, many more. The future and the past, diametrically opposed and yet entwined in the inescapable dance of the present, looking to the future through the trick mirror of the past. As Anne Carson put it in an interview with Tacita Dean for Interview Magazine, all time is now. It's something of a defeatist mentality to say that if human experience is shared and repeated, if our stories are no more original than the act of retelling them, it must be impossible to innovate or to produce art which is truly original. What changes is the way in which you reshape the clay you've been given. The line between a work which is derivative and which is paying successful homage depends largely on the skill with which it's performed and the nuance of the performance. Borrow this from that and add it here. 300,000 years and we still tell the same stories the same ways. We return to the same waters we have been for centuries. It feeds into itself like a spiral. Did Heracles sing songs passed down by his ancestors on the road home? When the passengers of Kamua Kamuti reach their destination, will the chorus fall silent? Even reproductions are not, as we imagine them, perfect photocopies of their forebears. Every time that a piece of music is played, it's played differently. It's the nature of something created with human hands and the human spirit. Every version is changed slightly, even imperceptibly. There are subtleties to be found, emotions that arise. Every performer leaves their mark on a piece of music. It's why there's still anything new to say about the same piece, even hundreds of years later. These refractions and interpretations can be a thing of beauty, themselves original. They lay the piece bare, reveal hidden elements that another may not have seen. No two people are ever truly looking at the same moon. We carry our associations, our memories, our projections into everything that we perceive. When we approach a piece of art, a story, a feeling, it's the same. How much of the self is left behind in a work of art? Even in repetition, the same note played by two different pairs of hands will reveal these differences and refractions. The impossibility of a truly shared perception is something that seems very lonely, but it's really something very beautiful that allows for these differences to emerge, to change the material just so, to reshape the clay, to reimagine, to see differently, feel differently, to tell the story in a different order, in a different voice. You are new to this time and place, in this body. You bring your perspective, your experience, to all that you create. You are what cannot be replicated. In your perception of a piece of art, a story, you see the image of your own likeness in the reflecting pool as you pass through. I am looking at you and seeing a reflection of myself, but you are looking at me and seeing a reflection of yourself. But maybe there's a point at which our eyes meet, and for a second, we're truly looking at each other. The image conjured in the middle of these spaces creates something new entirely. In Guilty, translated by Stuart Kendall, Georges Bataille writes, "I hate the image of a being linked to isolation. I laugh at the solitary who claims he reflects the world. He cannot reflect it. being himself the center of the reflection, he ceases to be the measure of that which does not have a center. I imagine that the world does not resemble any separate enclosed being, but what passes from one to another when we laugh or make love. Imagining this, immensity is open to me, and I lose myself in it. If we share everything, then we have nothing to bring to each other. From the largest to the smallest possible scale, the differences in our perception create the human experience.